Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back the co-founder of PeakProsperity.com, author of best-selling book, Prosper, How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting. How are you, Chris Martinson?
Why, thank you. It's good to be back here on the show with you and your listeners. I'm doing very well. Just came through the 4th of July festivities and all of that, and had some time recently to ponder and think about everything. And I've spent a month in Buenos Aires. I just got back last week, so got a good long look at another country, which, by the way, Argentina isn't even an emerging market economy. It's still considered a frontier economy. It's just still in such a shambles after successive poor governments had ruined that really fine country, proud people, great resources. On paper, it has everything it needs except good governance.
You know, it's interesting because we know that Venezuela, of course, is suffering a terrible runaway inflation. I suppose if you're living there, it definitely feels like a hyperinflation leading to incredible social unrest in the area. Do you see something similar ahead for Argentina, or maybe it's not quite that bad there?
Well, it's headed there. You know, the largest note they had is a 500 peso note to supersede the 100 peso note. And now there's, I think they're on their way. They're getting a 1,000 peso note. They're looking at officially a little over 21% inflation, unofficially probably higher. And of course, after the 1,000 peso note, there'll be the 2,000, then the 5, then the 10,000, on and on. And so from that, you know, I'm still shocked that Janet Yellen and Draghi get to sit in front of fine committees and say, you know, we're a little worried inflation is too low. Because if they, by extension, they're saying inflation's good and it's helpful, and if we had more of it, our markets would be better and people would be happier. But I just like, well, just why don't you go to a country with high inflation and you'll see misery? It's awful. Inflation is not good for people. It's good for banks. It's good for big banks. It's good for a credit generation machine, but it's not good for people. And that's why I can't believe that Yellen and Draghi aren't literally raked over the coals. Or maybe figuratively, but I'd go for literal if possible, by people, you know, who are, they're testifying before.
You know, the irony there is that Dr. Yellen is now noted the end of economic discomfort, I guess I'll call it, here in the United States. What world are they living in? I used to wonder, you know, did Ben Bernanke actually pump his own gasoline into the fuel tank when he drove up, or did the chauffeur? It seems as though they're in their ivory towers and they have lost touch with reality.
The elites are dangerously out of touch, of course, and one of my chief complaints about the Federal Reserve over time has been that it has a very long track record of staffing itself and selecting for its leadership people who are academics, never operated a profit and loss, you know, center in their entire lives, not responsible for hiring in the normal way where you have to hire somebody and make sure that their productivity is a good fit for the organization. So, yeah, they're a little out of touch. And you know, that whole idea of Bernanke not maybe ever filling up his own tank, I thought that same thing when Larry Summers, remember that whole war on cash a little while ago, and Larry Summers came out and actually wrote an article and said, you know, $100 bill is just, you don't need that. It's just too big of a, it's too big. You know, it's used for crime. I'm like, really, Larry, you need to go grocery shopping because you can fit $100 in a bag now. Not too hard, you know? So they're very much out of touch. And I think it's highly dangerous because they don't understand that really economics is not a science and it's not a bunch of math functions. It's really, money is an idea. So really it's a social convention. It's an agreement we hold. And you don't just simply erode that agreement without effects. And they don't understand those effects because they don't understand that really the social glue that keeps everything together. You mentioned Venezuela. That's what happens when your social glue breaks down. It gets messy quick. It's extended. Every single market I track is just nuts at this point in time, giving signals that nobody can make sense of. You know, oil falling, even though the Middle East is about to erupt and nobody can figure out why. And it's just how markets with too much liquidity and a couple of robots, computer robot algorithms running it, this is just how these things go. But you know, where the Federal Reserve doesn't have appropriate experience to read the signals properly on their end, we're not getting appropriate pricing signals either. And these things are, of course, very damaging, I think.
But, you know, on the other side, you know, these folks managing the algorithms, the just a recipe. I mean, we've all, I'm sure, made something at some point in a kitchen somewhere, a piece of toast. It's a recipe. I mean, obviously, the AI revolution is not going back into the bottle. You don't think it's creating better liquidity, for instance? You don't buy that argument?
No, not even for a minute, because a huge amount of these quantitative programs, they don't actually hold anything. They'll trade in and out, in and out, in and out, and many of them are going home flat at the end of the day. So there's no additional liquidity provided. There's the appearance of liquidity, because you might say, wow, a billion shares traded. But if 500 million of those just went zipping around from pocket A to pocket B, but went home flat at the end of the night, if those, or when, I should say, these algorithms get into, well, here's a phrase, an out-of-parameter condition, right? Something happens in the world, the algorithm is not, wasn't programmed to handle a fat tail or a real outlier, so it looks at the conditions and says, that's it, I'm out of here. And when they do, that's why we see these flash crashes all the time now. They happen in all kinds of markets. They've happened in things as large as the U.S. dollar market, the U.S. treasury market. We see them in individual shares, and of course, all of our long-suffering listeners who watch these so-called flash crashes happen mysteriously on gold and silver. This is just what happens when algorithms come and really assault prices and do things because look, they make money at it. But if there's not money to be made and the conditions are wrong, they'll just go away. So what looks like liquidity is actually false liquidity, easy come, easy go, but it's not actually real liquidity.
No, it's interesting because, you know, most articles we read today indicate the public, it really isn't investing in the markets, not as we saw in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Why don't we shift over to the bread and butter of the show here? Of course, the yellow metal and AG. We had a really solid 2016. We'd like to see some more of that. Give us an idea of what you think is going on and whether or not we'll see better times ahead for the precious metals.
Well, I've been on this bandwagon for a while. I am... 99.99% convinced that these are heavily manipulated markets. And we know that that's the case when we look at AG, for instance, the silver market. You know, I heard through Ted Butler that JP Morgan has been short silver every single minute of the time for about 9 years, has never lost a penny doing that. So how is it that you can be short something that long of a stretch and never lose any money at it? Well, there's only one way. That's if there's no risk. That's if you control the markets in the way you want to do it. And that's what they do. So I think they've got, you know, maybe we don't have to understand any ulterior motives like, you know, keep precious metals under lock and key and suppressed so that people retain confidence that they might otherwise lose in fiat money. Forget that. JP Morgan makes money doing what they do. And the bullion banks all make money hand over fist doing bear raids. The only mystery to me, Chris, at this point in the time is, who's on the other side of these trades at this point? JP Morgan never loses. I'm watching all of this. And by the way, it's not personal about gold and silver. I see this level of manipulation in every single market I'm looking at. It was a huge problem that started to erupt under Bush II. Obama did nothing to begin to reel this stuff in. The big banks now have absolute control over all of these markets. You see JP Morgan, not to pick on them. I could pick on other ones. But again, the proprietary trading desk in 2016, out of 200-plus trading days, lost money on zero of those days, right? So you're a trader. You know what it's like. You have good days. You have bad days. I considered myself super successful if I got to the 60% win ratio. To have a 0% loss ratio means there's no risk. And so that's the world the big banks operate in, and I think they continue to do that until it breaks on them. So, you know, my story in this is, look, have gold and silver. You got to own it because this is going to be one of those before and after stories. I don't know what the after event is. Is it North Korea flares up, the Middle East blows up, something. But, you know, things are going to evolve very, very rapidly once they begin to move all of this suppressed volatility that's been with us for years and years now. It makes me bored to tears to even try and look at the markets right now because they do nothing. It's unpredictable. So with that, you know, once the volatility comes back, it's one of those overshoot, the pendulum goes too far the other way. I think we have wicked high volatility. And under those circumstances, I don't think it's going to be possible for retail-level people to really meaningfully get their hands on gold or silver or a variety of other hard assets that we could talk about.
But what about the listener who's saying, you know, Chris Mortensen, I have access to precious metals on eBay, Amazon.com, all around the web. There's so many delivery services who can bring the physical bullion to my door. I can go to goldmoney.com and I can have digital precious metals. I can transfer into all different types of contracts in the precious metals, including the ETFs. I mean, there's so many, or maybe the Central Fund of Canada, you know, with gold and silver in the holdings. Can you give us an idea of how this might develop in such a way that the typical investor is caught off guard, simply cannot procure any physical?
Well, absolutely. So we've already seen hints of this, right? It was a number of years ago. I actually, for whatever reason, happened to be in Laguna Beach, California. I was at Mike Maloney's shop, and gold and silver were just taking these huge, giant waterfalls. And over the next couple of days, all the silver they had was gone because people who wanted to buy silver said, well, this is a buying opportunity. And when I talked to them there, they have, you know, they got a lot of customers and so they got a good sense of the pulse. And when I was talking to their sales agents, I asked, you know, are these new people showing up who are waiting? They're like, oh no, these are all return customers. And then over the next 8 weeks, it was impossible. You had got these 6-8 week waiting times to get silver because it's not like there's a huge stockpile. It's not like the mint just, you know, can suddenly start churning out many, many million more, silver eagles. So what happened in that moment was, there was a price event, and it excited enough of the existing silver holders, which have to be some very small percentage of total U.S. people, to say, hey, I want to get more. And that alone completely dried up the pipeline. So sure, maybe, you know, if you really begged and borrowed, you might be able to convince somebody to part with theirs. But in these quick moments, what we've learned is that the delivery pipeline is actually pretty thin and has a very narrow capacity. So my view of this is that once things begin to devolve again, and we get into this new territory, and let's say now 10% of Americans suddenly get it in their head that they want to have gold or silver, I think you see the retail side of that story dry up very quickly. I think that, you know, then your access is a fraction of the ease that it currently is. And, of course, the very, very wealthy will always have easier access. The billionaires will be able to go through, you know, the big bank clearinghouses and vaults and trade stuff back and forth and have access to international vaults, all that. That will probably be true. But for the retail person, this is a before and after story. And I think after, it's just hard to get your hands on any because once you understand the total size of the pipeline for the retail side, it's...
So in other words, we're looking at a massive paper market and very little when the music stops, the bullion to go around. And as you say, I mean, this could become a problem very quickly. It could develop in a way that very few are prepared for. What are the first steps here?
Well, for anybody who doesn't have any exposure to precious metals, they should. You know, I would think a minimum 10% of your liquid net worth. And these are, you know, the physical bullion in your hot little hands. No ETFs, no paper games, no Bitgold, none of that stuff. Just, you know, this is, you can look at it, you can touch it, you can hold it somewhere safe. I mean, to put just a little context on this, if we said there's probably in the vicinity of around 1 billion ounces of silver available for investors, you go, wow, that sounds like a lot, 1 billion ounces. Well, at $16 an ounce, it's about $16 billion at current prices that's sort of kicking around. Hey, how much money has Bank of Japan and Central Bank of Europe, how much have they created this month? And the answer is $200 billion this month, right? $1.5 trillion new dollars flooded into the system already this year. So when you understand that amount of liquidity is out there, if that liquidity gets scared, and it will, and it wants to go somewhere safe, and it will, and that liquidity now understands that bank bail-ins are a real thing, so they don't even want to hold money in banks, and we might even see sovereign defaults coming forward, so they don't want to put their money there. The question is, where does it go? And that's always the age-old question. And, of course, when volatility returns, when all of that liquidity gets scared, the next question you should be asking is, well, where does it go? If I suddenly said, hey, you're in charge of $200 billion, make it safe, you'd have a time trying to figure out how you were going to do that. It's really hard to figure out. So, yeah, massive amounts of liquidity out there and not that many attractive assets at this point. Precious metals will have their day again, but they're being suppressed, and the U.S. government, the SEC, doesn't care, as long as they're suppressed downwards. I tell you, if we saw the reverse of these midnight raids where, you know, gold and silver get slammed somewhere between 12 and 2 in the morning, if we saw those slammed to the upside, I bet you anything we would be seeing SEC investigations. So that'll all come to an end at some point. It has to. It's just what suppression schemes always, for some reason, so the oldest one in the book, which is you created a mismatch between actual demand and supply and pricing.
Of course, what would people want? I mean, they're going to want something that's unencumbered when this scenario you've outlined here so aptly today comes to pass. I mean, frankly, digital spreadsheets could be worthless at that point. Is there anything else that comes to mind? I mean, I presume, well, obviously real estate and other assets, tangible assets, would be ideal.
Absolutely. In our book, Prosper, that's Prosper with an exclamation point at the end, what we talk about are 8 different forms of capital. Of course, have your financial capital well tended and grow that, keep it safe, all of that. You're going to be needing your financial capital, of course. But there are other forms of capital. One of them is your living capital, which is the health that you're in. You and I have talked about that in the past. But that could also be the garden or the orchard that you plant if you have those things available to you, and because of your living situation, you can do that. And your social capital, very important. Your material capital, very important. There's great investments to be had now that will both, I think, deliver nice returns, as well as give you great resilience if or when, you know, the future becomes volatile again, to say it nicely. That's really what we're talking about. And within each one of these 8 forms of capital, there are ways to deploy your financial capital so that you're really diversifying yourself and you're really spreading your wealth out in a good way, and great investments that can be had. And one of the things we're advising people to do is to get together a buy list of things that really you've had your eye on. They make sense. You understand them. This could be real estate. It could be commercial, residential. It could be land, timberland, things like that. But things with real, solid, intrinsic value that you understand, and just think, what would be a great price for those things? Understand what that is, and then be patient, because we think there's much better prices coming after some sort of a reset occurs when all of this trouble begins.
Some sort of reset. You've piqued my interest. And, you know, at the end of the day, what do you think might be that trigger moment when the dominoes start to fall?
Pretty much unknowable, but I have every confidence it will happen, because there always has to be a relationship between the money you print up and the stuff that it's going to buy. And so what's been happening is credit's been expanding at a horrific rate, 10, 11% per year globally for the past 10 years. How's the global economy doing? It's growing at a fraction of that, right? So, you know, when you constantly increase not just your debts that we hear about, but then also your unfunded liabilities that you failed to save properly for, things like that, when you put all that in the spot, we say, wow, the United States, just to pick on a country, has never had a larger pile of IOUs compared to the real economy ever. And standing at 1,100% debt to GDP, or IOUs to GDP. 1,100%, 11 times, right? And just growing, growing, growing. So I don't know when or what precipitates. I do know that when I look at a chart like that, I say only one question to ask, which is, who's going to eat the losses? Now, we already have answers to that, right? The people of Illinois have already discovered, oh, it's them. Bad decisions, horrible decisions, politically popular, but decisions were made and made and made. And now that the chickens are coming home to roost, well, 33% tax increase. And that's just to get things started, by the way. That doesn't even begin to address their problem. So that's what I think I see is coming. And so, of course, when you are overextended, the first question is, who's going to eat the losses? Is it going to be you or the person who loaned you the money? That's part one. Part two, when this reset starts to come, though, it is such a highly leveraged system that we don't know how to deleverage a system like this without it blowing up. That's the world we live in. It's either expanding or collapsing. And so we are so far off into crazy territory in this that when the reset comes, I think it's going to be pretty sharp, pretty violent. It's going to scare a lot of people. And here's the most interesting thing about this is the central banks are clearly scared of having any sort of downdraft start. Every time the stock market's down 1%, we have these mysterious save rallies that come in, and central bank officials are trotted out to say, oh, no, we didn't mean to say tightening, and on and on and on. And they're scared, and they're scared for it because they're scared. You should be scared. And the reason for that is that they know as well as anybody that if this gets rolling to the downside, it may not be possible to stop it before all of the excess and a little more is wrung out of the system. And if you track this back the way I do, this system started to get over-leveraged starting in the early 1980s. It started to correct in 94, 95. Greenspan freaked out, went to a 0% fractional reserve policy, flooded the market. We got the dot-com craze. That crashed. Then we got, on and on. So it's a failure to live within our means for so many decades. Nobody wants to see what happens when that corrects to the mean or reverse. So that's the world we're in. I don't know what precipitates it. It could be a wayward statement by somebody. It could be that Russia's got coders who coded the HFT machines, slipped some back doors in, and they decide to pull the plug because we've done something to them. Who knows? Doesn't matter at this point. We're too overextended to grow out of this. So the question is, who's going to eat the losses? But I am smart enough to know that if I have my assets in my hot little hands, I have a better chance of holding on to them.
No, it's really well said. And I like at least two of the issues you raised. And firstly, the pension apocalypse is really what it points to, because yes, Chicago, Illinois, the canaries in the coal mine, which will be the next to fall. And we could point to numerous, municipalities and states. And then, of course, you bring up this great idea that we're awash in liquidity. What they're not lending, they're holding on to so much of that liquidity and or directing it into the capital markets, purchasing their own shares. So at some point when that money becomes scared, it might just be the chaotic system trigger point that I think that you're pointing to today. All right. Co-founder of peakprosperity.com. Please tell us a bit more about what people will find.
Well, it's a wonderful website with a great community. We're discussing what we call the three E's, economy, energy, environment. You have to put all three together if you want to know why we're in the mess we're in. So we stitch those three together, and then, of course, that's problem definition. That's no good without a solution set. So the crash course is our prime offering at Peak Prosperity around the three E's. Watch enough of that to go, yeah, I need to do something, and then join the conversation. That's where Prosper the book comes in. And we've got What Should I Do guides, and as well, a newsletter, paid newsletter for people who like to go a little deeper, want a lot more context, want to understand the kinds of things we analyze in more depth. Recent articles that go into great depth on cryptocurrencies, on the energy markets, on things like that. So we're pretty wide-ranging and very thoughtful, curious, intelligent crew of people have assembled there.
We'll look forward to covering some of these topics in much greater detail in the next discussion.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.